Right, hello everybody. As Matt said, I'm going to talk to you today about 100 years of gravitational lensing, going from 1919 with the Eddington eclipse, the first observation of gravitational lensing, to the kinds of lenses that we study now here in 2019. And I'll give a bit of an historical perspective, and I'll try to highlight the history that Cambridge has played, or the role that Cambridge has played, in the history of gravitational lensing. So to begin, we're going to start with the gravity part of gravitational lensing. And you all know what gravity is, right? It's the idea that what goes up must come down. Yeah? We're familiar with that? So what goes up must come down. That's gravity, except when it's not. So that's the Voyager 1 probe. And it will never come down to the Earth again. It went up. But it's 42 years later, it won't even come back to the sun. It's going to escape the solar system completely. So sometimes our intuitive ideas about gravity maybe don't actually work all of the time. But gravity is nevertheless a really, really compelling scientific theory. So the first Cambridge connection is with that character, Isaac Newton, who realized that the same thing that makes a tennis ball fall back to the Earth, he had no idea what a tennis ball was, but regardless, and makes a pencil fall onto the floor, is also what causes the motions of all of the objects in our solar system. Now, it might sound obvious today, but before we had a law of gravity, that is extraordinarily non-intuitive, that the ball falling back to the Earth is the same physics as the Earth going around the Sun and the Moon going around the Earth. It really, really, genuinely, truly was a scientific revolution. The motions of all of these objects are really complicated when you look at them in their apparent motions. And Newton was able to synthesize it all down to a very, very simple relation between masses and distances. It probably is, the formulation of the law of gravity, the beginning of modern science and physics. Okay, so he did a really good job, except for Mercury, which many of you might see transit, weather permitting, on Monday. So there's an issue with Mercury in that Newton can predict its motion except one aspect of it. So Newton's gravity says that objects going around the Sun are on elliptical orbits. And that's also true of Mercury. Mercury goes around the Sun on an elliptical orbit. But the funny thing about Mercury, actually this happens with all of the planets, but it's most noticeable with Mercury, is that the orientation of the ellipse changes with time. After 1,000 years, instead of going like this, it will start to go like this. And after thousands of years later, its orientation will eventually be in the other direction. And this is an effect called precession. And it's not killer to Newtonian gravity, because Mercury doesn't go around the Sun in an isolated sense. It's going around the Sun whilst all of the other planets are also going around the Sun. And those other planets perturb the orbit of Mercury, leading to something called precession, this change of the orientation with time over thousands of years. And one remarkable thing about this is that astronomers were able to measure this change in orientation very, very precisely. And Newton's laws allow you to calculate what you expect very precisely as well. And there's a mismatch. And the mismatch isn't massive. It's only 7.5%. So if Newton's laws have it going around 7.5% slower than what we actually observe. But the measurements are sufficiently precise to have made people worried about this for a very long time. So what's the problem? Either we have to invoke something else in the solar system to explain that anomaly, or we have to move beyond Newton's gravity. And that's where Einstein comes in. So Einstein had a different idea about how gravity works. He keeps Newton's basic idea that objects that have mass are attracted to each other, and the amount of attraction depends on how far or close they are to each other. But he added this idea that the idea, the concept of having mass implies a change to the way that space works. And so he formulated this idea that mass creates a curvature in the fabric of space. Now, try to imagine that in three dimensions, and you will fail. It's impossible. But we have schematics for attempting to imagine it in two dimensions. So the white grid lines here are meant to display space. The yellow object is a massive component of space, let's say the sun. And because the yellow object has mass, because the sun is massive, it leads to a curvature, a bending, a warping of space. And so the result of that is that objects which would get attracted to the yellow object via Newtonian gravity have this additional component of also sort of feeling this little bit of a warp in space-time. And usually this isn't a big deal, but in certain circumstances, for example with Mercury, it is. And this curvature can lead to precisely the precession that we need to explain for Mercury. So I'll show you that in this video. So here is a warped space-time, and if you have a yellow object, not the sun this time, going around a more massive object, this isn't gravity at play here. The phenomenon that you're seeing here is due to the curved nature of the rubber sheet. And you see that the orbit of the yellow ball is precessing. So you naturally get this precession just from the fact that there's this curvature on the surface that is going around. And so Einstein's idea that if space-time is curved around massive objects naturally leads to the precession, it resolves the Mercury anomaly. Mercury all of a sudden acts as one would expect. And there are some other features that happen as a result of this as well. So first of all, Einstein also said, let's assume that light, even though it has no mass, also experiences gravity. And we say gravity is the attraction between two massive objects. Einstein said E equals mc squared, so energy, which light is, and mass are the same thing. Then if you have a ray of light that goes near a massive object, like the sun, it will have its trajectory changed. It will get attracted to the sun just by normal Newtonian gravity, but it will also have its trajectory changed by going into this warped dip. And if the massive object, the yellow object, is sufficiently dense, the curvature becomes infinite so that the photon would fall into an infinite well. It could never escape. And that's precisely what a black hole is. And that's precisely not what this talk is about. Okay, so the idea is that you have a massive object like the sun. The star shines some light. It's shining light in every direction, including back there and into the void and so on. And by default, if the sun weren't there, then a ray of light like this would just carry on in this direction, and we would never observe it from Earth. Instead, we would have observed a ray of light going like that. But because the sun is here, the ray of light that would have come to the Earth would get deflected this way. And this ray of light that we shouldn't see instead gets gravitationally attracted to the sun. It doesn't fall into the sun because the sun's not massive enough. But it gets attracted to us, and we see the ray of light. We see the ray of light coming from this direction. So we perceive the light to have come from a different direction than it's actually come. And that is gravitational lensing. So the phenomenon could be even more exotic. Let's say that you're observing some object in the distant universe from Earth, and there's a massive object in between, let's say a cluster of galaxies. This object emits light rays that, without the cluster, would have never entered our telescope. But because the cluster is there, it bends the light gets attracted to the cluster and it feels the curvature of the cluster, so that the light does fall into our telescope. And then when we trace these two rays of light backwards, one appears to be coming from this location, and the other appears to be coming from that location. So we see the same object multiple times. Now this isn't particularly crazy. If any of you have spectacles and you put them up to a light at an askew angle, you'll be able to see multiple images of the light as well. So seeing multiple images of the same object isn't crazy. To say that gravity is acting like a lens in the same way as your spectacles really is kind of a weird idea. So how do we test this idea, this Einsteinian gravity. He was able to correctly predict the motions of Mercury, but he knew what the answer should be. So we want a new test of this general relativity theory, this Einsteinian gravity. And he came up with this idea that you can look at stars as their light passes by the sun, essentially a scenario just like this, and if the stars appear in deviant positions than where they're supposed to be, in a specific way, so the closer you are to the sun, the more you should deviate, the further you are away, you don't feel the effects of the sun anymore. If we can observe that, then that would be a verification of general relativity. Now the problem is that it's very, very hard to see stars sat right next to the sun. And so the experiment that him and Arthur Eddington came up with, and at the time Eddington was the director of the Cambridge Observatory, so the second Cambridge connection, was to wait till a solar eclipse of the sun happened, where the solar eclipse blocks out the light of the sun, allowing you to see the stars behind it, and measure any potential deviation from where they are when the sun's not there. So Eddington was a smart man. He went to the tropics with some telescopes, because it's nicer than rainy November days in Cambridge. And he took this image, which is also outside on the first poster out there, and he measured the positions of stars in this image and characteristically calculated how far they were from where they would be if the sun is not there. And so this was done 100 years and 5 months ago, and 100 years to the date, he presented his results to the Royal Astronomical Society. And so this is the figure. So just to explain the figure, on the right side is closer to the sun, and this is the how much you were deflected, how much you deviate from where you're supposed to be. So when you're far from the sun, the deviation is zero. When you're closer to the sun, the deviation is order one arc second. And let me just demystify what these lines all mean. So this is the trend that you would get if light was attracted to the sun just using Newtonian gravity. But when you add Einstein's curvature due to general relativity, this is what you expect, and this is what Arthur Eddington measured 100 years ago. And this is kind of a big deal. And it's kind of a big deal because Newton's theory was so good. It was really, really a change in the way people viewed the physical world. He wrote down a very simple equation and described all of celestial mechanics. That is massive, and it changed the way that people did view the world. And then Einstein now has come along and said, but that still wasn't good enough. This is well and truly a scientific revolution. To say that the best scientific theory we had is demonstrably wrong is a big deal. And it was such a big deal that the press loved it. And this is not today's press, which eats anything up. I mean, you could tweet about it and everybody would go in a flurry. This was the conservative press 100 years ago. But not only that, not only did the press at the time, in 1919, put it on the front page of their newspapers, 80 years later, Einstein was recognized as the person of the century because of this. There were a lot of people that did a lot of great things in the 20th century, but nobody created such a massive scientific revolution as Einstein's gravity. No Cambridge connection. Okay, then what happened? 1919, we see our first lensing, and then nothing for 60 years. There's a few papers in the literature about theoretical aspects of lensing, and then nothing until we come to our next Cambridge connection. In 1979, three astronomers, including Bob Carswell, who's an emeritus faculty here in Cambridge, found this object whose properties, there's actually two objects here, and they have extraordinarily similar properties. They are twins. It's almost like you're seeing two of the same object. Almost like it was a gravitationally lensed quasar. And indeed, if you look at this object with the Hubble Space Telescope, you see one quasar here and another quasar here in a big, massive galaxy that's doing the lensing. So you have a single quasar whose rays of light have taken different paths through the universe into your telescope, and so you're seeing two images of it because of the deflection from that massive galaxy there. So that was 1979. Fast forward 40 years into the future, we have two really fantastic satellites that are currently operating, the WISE satellite operating at mid-infrared wavelengths, and the Gaia satellite, which provides amazing high-quality imaging across the entire sky. And as a result of that, we now have hundreds of lensed quasars. We've gone from one 40 years ago to about 300 now, and 100 of those have been discovered in the past 2 years. About 90 of them.
Wow.
I know, right? 90 of them from a PhD student that sat in these seats six months ago. He graduated in May. So another Cambridge connection. He is single-handedly responsible for, at this point, one-third of all of the known lens quasars. Not bad for a 3.5-year PhD. Imagine if he'd been around in 79, we'd have like hundreds of thousands of quasars, right? Okay, so at this point, we might be asking, are all lensed objects quasars? Because the only lenses I've shown you are quasar lenses. And the answer is no. Galaxies also lens other galaxies, and they lens them into these Einstein rings, these arc-like features. So instead of seeing four points, we now have streaks and smears and arcs and rings. And this is the first example of a galaxy lensing another galaxy. And it was discovered in 1995 by Steve Warren at Imperial College and Paul Hewitt, whose office is about 50 meters that way, so another Cambridge connection. So Cambridge discovered the first quasar lens and discovered the first galaxy lens. These are all lenses that I've discovered, and I guess I'm in Cambridge. I like these because some of them are really cool. There's some really nice streaks, and I'm going to turn the lights down a little bit. So you have some really red arcs, which is weird. Most lenses don't look red. We have bullseyes. That's pretty crazy. So these are all real images from the Hubble Space Telescope. Here there's a dust lane going through the lens. That's different. And we now know of hundreds of galaxies being lensed by other galaxies as well. So here's just a rogues gallery. Here's another red arc. They come in all shapes and sizes, green arcs even. I'm going to highlight one of these objects. And what's peculiar about that one?
Two rings.
There's two rings. So you have this very chance alignment of a massive galaxy sitting in front of two other galaxies at different distances who are now both lensed into Einstein arcs and Einstein rings. Really, really spectacular. And we think that in the near future we'll find hundreds of more of these. They have amazing scientific potential as well. Okay, so I've shown you a bunch of lenses now. Most of them look like this. They're these red spheroidal galaxies, very regular in nature. None of them look at all like the Milky Way. The Milky Way has a disk. It's got spiral arms. It's got star formation, blue stars, red stars. So are there lenses that look like the Milky Way? Well, the answer is yes, but there are many fewer than the other lenses, because the Milky Way is not a very massive galaxy, so it's a less effective lens than those other massive galaxies I was showing you. But we do have, at this point, about 25, maybe 30 Milky Way-like lenses. They're also hard to confirm as lenses, because there's a lot going on in Milky Way-like galaxies. You've got spiral arms, and so you have to distinguish between the background arc and features of the actual foreground galaxy that's doing the lensing. So it's a lot more difficult to find Milky Way-like lenses, but we're endeavoring, and we have found a few. Okay, so we have a few Milky Way-like lenses, we've got galaxies lensing quasars, but that's really just the tip of the iceberg. The real action is when you go to galaxy clusters. Okay, so galaxy clusters are aggregations of many galaxies that are attracted to each other based upon their mutual gravitational force. They're sort of analogs to, you know, the planets going around the sun or stars going around a galaxy. These are galaxies going around galaxies in a cluster-like environment. And so all of the yellowish, orangish, reddish things you see here are galaxies that are all physically associated. They're all bound by their mutual gravitational attraction. And so there's a lot of mass here. It's an extremely massive environment. And if you have a lot of mass, you'll have a lot of lensing. And indeed, there are more lenses in this figure than I could show. So there's this massive arc here, there's this arc, there's that arc. All of these objects are being gravitationally lensed. There's a red arc up here, another arc. Hundreds of lenses in these images. Here's another example. Basically, all of the blue stuff that you see in these images are background objects that are being lensed. They're not all lensed into multiple images, but they're being made significantly brighter by the lensing effect from the gravitational lensing. And so you see, yeah, just magnificent large arcs. And you see those? There's like six different points, which are all the same object, but it's like a lens within a lens. It's a single galaxy within a cluster, leading to lenses within lenses. And then there's things like that, which I'll show you a different example of here. I mean, that to me looks like a cross alien.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, exactly. Hopefully aliens aren't as angry as that one looks. But so these are the same object, just with mirror lens effectively applied to it. So these cluster lenses really, really are fantastic. And again, lots of the stuff in this image is actually being lensed. Okay, so pretty pictures are all well and good, but what have we really learned here about the universe? Well, the first thing is that general relativity is a really good description for gravity. The lensing that it predicts works. But is GR the best description of gravity? Well, there are people who don't like gravity in its current formulation because one thing that when we look at galaxies and we look at clusters and we look at how gravity is acting in them, that gravity implies the presence of dark matter. And dark matter, some scientists are really skeptical about, maybe rightly so even. And so they've devised changes in gravity to do away with dark matter, so-called modified theories of gravity. And one person who wrote a lot about dark matter was Fritz Zwicky. He was one of the earliest people to suggest that dark matter was necessary to describe the motions of objects that we see in clusters of galaxies. But he was also open-minded about maybe gravity being wrong. He wrote, for example, on the assumption that Newton's inverse square law accurately describes interactions among, he wrote, nebulae, we would now call them galaxies. So on the assumption that it works, here's the rest of my paper. But he was crazy. He was willing to write about things that he knew were broken as well. He also wrote several papers about lensing in the 1930s. Okay, so let's try to see if gravitational lensing can tell us that dark matter doesn't exist. And so I did this with an undergraduate student here in Cambridge about 5 years ago now. And we looked at this object. So here you have a very, very massive yellowish-reddish galaxy. And here's a background galaxy that's been lensed into this massive spiral structure that's so large that if you had a telescope who was sensitive enough to see it, you wouldn't need a large aperture at all to resolve it. In fact, the telescopes that we hear on site would resolve this gravitational lens. And we did a calculation and we asked, how much mass do you need to get such a massive ring, such a wide ring? And the answer is 8 times as much mass as you have in stars. So this is using the modified gravity theory. With the modified gravity theory, you need 8 times as much mass as you observe in stars. Newtonian gravity would require even more. The discrepancy comes in because there is dark matter. This object overwhelmingly confirms the existence of dark matter in the universe. If it's not dark matter, it is something even more exotic than dark matter. And this isn't the only observation. So galaxies are made of stars. And stars act like imperfections on the lens. Instead of having a smooth mass, you have a granular mass, the mass of all of the stars added together. And this is similar to having imperfections on the surface of any other lens. For example, any piece of water acts as a lens because it has a refractive index. And so if you have a pool that has ripples on the top of it, those ripples are imperfections on the surface of the lens. And those imperfections lead to areas of very high magnification. If you've ever gone snorkeling without a shirt and you got burned because of these high magnification regions. And low magnification regions here. And in the exact same way, the stars in a galaxy create very, very small but noticeable deviations from smoothness. They create ripples, anomalous magnifications and demagnifications on the lensing. And we observe these. We observe the ripples from the stars in the galaxy. Now, if all of the mass in a galaxy were stars, there would be lots and lots of ripples because there would be lots and lots of stars. It would be like taking your pool, your swimming pool, and really shaking it. And when you do that, these things become ubiquitous, and you no longer have any sort of concrete structure. From our observations of lenses like this, we know that the universe isn't that. It's not all shook up. And so, if not all of the mass is in stars, it has to be in something else. Once again, this implies dark matter. So this effect is something called microlensing. Okay, so we probably need dark matter. But by the way, what is that? I mean, that's a real image. What's going on there? Well, here's a big hint. It's lensing. So you have a massive galaxy in the center of this image that also has a little satellite companion, kind of like the Magellanic Clouds to the Milky Way. And the background object is a quasar. You have 1, 2, 3, 4 images of the quasar. And quasars are these really, really, really bright objects. They're the brightest objects in the universe that are being powered by accretion onto a supermassive black hole. And usually they outshine the galaxies they live in by a factor of 100 or more. But because of the gravitational lensing, the quasar has just sat there, but the galaxy that it's lived in is getting stretched out into these massive Einstein rings. And so we're seeing the galaxy that the quasar lives in, which is extraordinarily difficult to see otherwise. And so we can begin to dissect it. So now, for not necessarily the first time, but at these distances, essentially the first time, we're seeing the host galaxy of a quasar. And we can see that the inner region where the quasar is, the host galaxy is red. And so that's probably a red bulge of the host galaxy. And then there's all of these structures. Does anybody just want to shout out what they might think those are? They're spiral arms. The host galaxy is a spiral arm. So we have Einstein rings of the bulge, Einstein rings of the spiral arms. You see these blue bits? Those are star-forming regions within the spiral arms. You wouldn't see this without the lensing, because all that you would be able to see is the bright quasar. Okay, sometimes things aren't so easy. So here's another quasar lens, and you have absolutely zero evidence that there's any galaxy at all. But with some very clever image processing techniques, boom. So that is a galaxy hosting a quasar at one of the furthest distances we've ever seen. And you guys are some of the first people to have seen. Okay, so we see galaxies under quasars. We also see the first galaxies that were born by using the magnifying power of gravitational lenses. So these three red objects here, 1, 2, 3, and these three red objects here, 1, 2, 3, these are the same as these. And the only way that you can see these things, they're very, very far away, so they're very, very faint. The only way that we can see them is the magnifying power of the cluster that they all live in. Okay. So just to wrap up, because Matt stood there now, general relativity is an excellent theory of gravity. Dark matter is necessary to describe our lensing observations. We can see quasar hosts in detail, the galaxies that quasars live in, using lensing. And it also provides us insights into the oldest, or in some sense youngest, the first galaxies born in the universe. Thank you for your time. What questions do you have?